May I have one of those? I would like one, thank you. This has nothing to do with Obadiah? That's terrific. Oh, sure it does. It's got all to do with Obadiah. The book of Obadiah is about the Edomites. And the reason you're back there in Genesis is because Esau is Edom. You recall Jacob and Esau, the twin brothers? The Genesis 25 is going to say the elder shall serve the younger. Why don't we go over there and read that for just a moment? We'll read a couple of those passages and we'll come back. Can you hear me with it? Better with it? Okay. I feel like I'm in concert or something, holding a microphone like that. Genesis 25. I'm about to be fixed. My wife has been trying to do that for some time now. It's a work in progress. Genesis chapter 25. Caleb's back. Why don't we just do Obadiah this week?
Okay. What we were trying to do, here's what's going on. I'm sorry for what seems to be a confusion. Basically, Lee Davis was supposed to be here to speak tonight, but unfortunately, he got food poisoning this afternoon. And so he called me about 5 o'clock, and so I was going to do Obadiah, which is what is scheduled for tonight. But then here comes Eric, who's supposed to be here next week. And so he was ready to do Jonah, which is his topic for next week. He just happens to be here a week early. So we were going to see if we could switch him and do his lesson and then let Lee speak next week. But I can't get a hold of him. I can't get a hold of him to switch it. So at any rate, we'll just go with the plan as it is. Now tonight, we're on Obadiah. So turn to the book of Obadiah if you're not already there. Now you know that Obadiah is rather unique among the minor prophets because he is one of those few minor prophets that deals primarily with a nation other than Israel or Judah. As we've been discussing in the minor prophets, they are dealing with various problems for the most part in Israel and Judah. You remember when we began our summer series, we started to discuss how that prophets in the Old Testament didn't primarily foretell the future. They did a lot of that, but that's very a small percentage of what the prophets did in comparison to their acting as covenant enforcement mediators. Remember that phrase we covered pretty extensively? We talked about how that a prophet is dealing with a covenant, which is an agreement between two or more parties. In this case, an agreement between God and the descendants of Israel, so it's a covenant. And then the prophets are enforcing that covenant. That is, they're saying, you are bound to follow these principles that you agreed to back at Sinai and subsequently with God. You've made a deal here. And for you to go off and to use the Old Testament language, to go a-whoring after other gods, that's not proper according to the covenant. And you're going to be punished. So they're mediating between God and man on this account. They're saying, here is God's word to you. And that is that you are failing to keep the covenant. So primarily they are enforcing a covenant by mediating between God and man. They are covenant enforcement mediators. And that's the case with almost all of them. But they are not all dealing with Judah or Israel. And so some of them are not enforcing the covenant of Moses. They are enforcing God's general law for all men. I think you're all aware that the law of Moses was not for everybody. The law of Moses never was for all the people on the earth. It was just for what group of people? Just for the Israelites. And so the Edomites weren't bound to hold to the law of Moses. They weren't keeping the Sabbath day. And they weren't bound to keep the Sabbath day, for example, or to do the various ceremonial aspects of the law of Moses. However, they were under a law of God too. And if you want to read about that in some detail, you can study the second chapter of the book of Romans. And that discusses how that the Gentiles, during the days of the law of Moses, were subject to a moral law, or some kind of law that was written on their hearts. And I suppose that God communicated to them in other ways too, for example, through the prophet Jonah, which we'll talk about next week. You know, Jonah was not telling the Ninevites you better follow the law of Moses. That wasn't what he was telling them, was it? He was telling them, be moral. Follow what God has told you. Do what God has delivered to you, the word that perhaps through other prophets God had told the Ninevites to follow. So that's the context here, that this is one of those books like Jonah and like the book of Nahum, which is also directed toward the Ninevites later on. Obadiah is one of those books that's directed toward other people primarily. Now, it does conclude with a section on how the children of Israel would get to reclaim Jerusalem after they came back from Babylonian captivity. Now, you remember that the minor prophets, as we've been discussing, are in the context of pre-captivity, that is, before Babylonian captivity for Judah, before Assyrian captivity for Israel, the northern tribes. Northern tribes is Israel, southern tribes is Judah. So the prophets are dealing with before the captivity, and then some during the captivity, and then post-captivity. So the minor prophets are all surrounding this period when the children of Israel, both in the northern 10 tribes of Israel and the southern 2 tribes of Judah, would go off into captivity. So here's a book that's not dealing with Judah or Israel. It's dealing with Edom. And Edom is the descendants of who? Esau. Very good. Now, Edom probably refers to redness. And so it refers to perhaps even the complexion of Esau. We're not sure how that word originally came to be associated other than the name of Esau. And that was the name that was given to him by his mother, Rebekah. Okay, let's read beginning in verse 1 of Obadiah. Any questions just about the kind of the lay of the land before we get into this? We're going to see why God is going to punish the Edomites. And it's because they have sinned against their brother. Who is their brother? In the flesh, Jacob is the brother of Esau. They were twins, right? But here we have the descendants of Jacob and the descendants of Esau, and the descendants of Esau have been badly mistreating the descendants of Jacob, and that's why they're going to be punished. Okay, here we go. Verse 1. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock. Now that refers to Mount Seir, or the mountainous area in which the Edomites lived, S-E-I-R. In fact, we should have a picture. I'm giving you the summary here, but here's the picture. The Seir Mountains, right here. Now Israel, if you'll notice, is up here at the top. And they are just south of Israel. In fact, the Edomites expanded into the southern part of Judah. And when the children of Judah were carried off into Babylonian captivity at the end of the 6th century B.C., there was a lot of vacant space. And what do the neighbors do when there's vacant space? They just sort of move into it and start to occupy it. And that's what the Edomites did when the children of Israel left. And they were on Nebuchadnezzar's side, by the way. When Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed Jerusalem and took away the Judeans captive, the Edomites were like cheerleaders. They were saying, let's go, drive them out. They hated their neighbors, so they were happy to see them go. But there's the land. Okay, now back to this outline. And I believe we're ready to read beginning in verse 3 again. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman. Okay, Teman is one of Esau's descendants, and it was also a chief city, probably near the northern border of Esau. So when he says, your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, he's referring to the mighty men of a city. So that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter because of the violence done to your brother Jacob. Okay, now notice that in verse 10, because of the violence done to your brother Jacob. There have been some people who have said Esau is, or Edom, is not literally referring to the people of Edom, but that it's referring to, it's like symbolic for people who rebel against God. Well, it may be symbolic in the sense that whoever's rebelling against God should learn a lesson from what's going on with Edom, but it's really referring to the literal people of Esau, because there are so many references to literal things. There may be some poetic language in there, but it's really referring to the Edomites. It's your brother Jacob. They have sinned against a particular group of people, the descendants of the Israelites, and they are living in a concrete location. It's kind of like in Luke chapter 16 when we read about the rich man and Lazarus, you know, and some people say that that's a parable, that that's not really literally true, that there never was a real rich man who is now in torment. But you know, at the beginning of the parable, Jesus said that there was a certain rich man who fared sumptuously. And so that's one of the reasons we know that that's a true story. That really is, did occur, and there really is a rich man who's in torment, and so on. That's the same principle here. Okay, shame shall cover you, verse 10, and you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, that is Jacob's wealth, that's when Babylon invaded Jerusalem, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. Now this is pretty tough stuff, isn't it? I mean, they had been so wicked to the children of Israel. This is not a light thing. Look at all the awful things they had done to Israel. Okay, now verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon all nations. Now, when you read in the prophets about the concept of the day of the Lord, that ought to send up a red flag in your mind, because it is referring to the day when God will settle accounts. And in the Old Testament, that might be referring to military punishment. It might be referring to a time when God sends a famine upon a people. It might be referring to captivity. But in 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter adapts that language of the day of the Lord and refers it to what? The day of the Lord then, that's going to come as a thief in the night, is the judgment day. So the Jews to whom he was writing would be very accustomed to this language about the day of the Lord, because that's the day when God will sort of pull back the curtain on the drama that's been going on. It's like, okay, here's this human drama that's going on, the play, and then God will just pull that curtain back and show that he's in charge of all this. He's going to show what's back of all of it, that he is the one who rewards, and he is the one who punishes, and he is the one who is in control. So he's been letting things go along. God has been letting people do what they decide to do, but then at one time, at the day of the Lord, he calls them all into account, and he's going to reward the righteous and mete out punishment to the unrighteous. Okay, y'all got that. Y'all are accustomed to that language. Okay, the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. That is, you've celebrated over the punishment of Israel when God used Babylon to punish Israel, when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem at the end of the 6th century. You partied when that happened, but now you're going to be conquered yourselves. They shall drink and swallow. It shall be as though they had never been. That is the Edomites. It'll be like the Edomites have never been. Isn't that remarkable? It's going to be like they, and you know, to this day, it's as if they had never been. I mean, they were basically assimilated. The Jews wind up conquering them during the intertestamental period. And that's not in the Bible. That's why it's called it's between the Testaments. You know, the intertestamental period is that approximately 400 years in between Malachi and Matthew. And it's during that period that the Edomites were just swallowed up by Jews that had come back from the Babylonian captivity and resettled there, and God gave them into their hands. So they did just disappear. And so when Obadiah says, it will be as though you have never been, that's exactly how it is. If you want to go find an Edomite today, you can't find one. No way to identify one. Okay. But in Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape. Now, what is Mount Zion? Okay, Jerusalem. In particular, the mountain where the temple was, but it's a word for Jerusalem. Mount Zion refers to Jerusalem. But in Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. And the house of Esau, what does it say? Stubble, or just a little mound of rocks. Okay, so in other words, Jacob is going to burn up Esau eventually. They shall burn them and consume them. I'm in verse 18. They shall burn them and consume them. And there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Those of the Negev, okay, the Negev, let's go back to our map here. The Negev is really this area. It can reach up into here, but it loosely refers to the area in the south of Israel. So right around in here is really where the Negev is. That's what I should say, right around in there. And it's that southern area in Israel that those people would possess Mount Esau. Those of the Shephelah, and we're going to read a couple of other words that refer to places where the Israelites had been carried off captive. And so they are going to come back and possess the land. Here it says the land of the Philistines. They shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria. And Benjamin shall possess Gilead. What he's talking about is captives returning and possessing their homeland again. Now, verse 20, the exiles of this host of the people of Israel, that exiles returning home, shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. And the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the Negev. Survivors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. One more note, and then we'll make some applications. Verse 21 says, survivors, that is, survivors from the captivity in Babylon, will go up to Mount Zion and rule Mount Esau. So here's the two mountains, and one is going to rule the other. And whereas Edom had been rebelling against the Israelites for so long and trying to cause them problems, in the end, this one mountain over here, Mount Zion, the capital of Judah, Jerusalem, is going to rule Mount Edom. So it's two mountains in comparison at the end, and one rules the other. That's clear, I think, to everyone. Okay, now I want you to notice on your chart here, does everybody have one of these? They were passed around at the beginning, so if you came in late and you need one of these, raise your hand. Okay, we have several who need one. So I have a stack here that was handed back to me. Noah, would you do this for me? Thank you. And just a brief explanation on this. I think I've got every passage in the Bible that refers to a conflict between the Israelites and the Edomites. And I've got it broken down into historical periods. So if you think that this conflict is a light thing, well, all you have to do is just a little bit of reading from these passages, and you will see how vicious the Edomites were toward the Israelites. Let's take an example of this. Let me see. There are an awful lot of passages here, and you can read them on your own time. You know, of course, the conflict goes all the way back to Jacob and Esau themselves. Wasn't there conflict between Jacob and Esau? And what happened on that score? About the birthright? And Esau sold his birthright, didn't he? That's right. Sold it to Jacob, and Jacob sort of played toward Esau's sensuality on that score. Played toward his desire to have his belly filled instead of to do what's right, and that's certainly true. What else happened? Well, the help of his mother was in the deception of Jacob when he was giving out the blessing. That's right. wind up coming out first, right? Okay, so then what else? Who remembers something else? What about the blessing? What happened about the blessing? Somebody help us out while I look up here.
Right.
That's right. Okay, so there was animosity right from the very beginning, wasn't there? Okay, good. Now let's notice some other passages. How about Numbers chapter 20? Let's go to this, and after we read Numbers 20, I will leave you to read the rest of these passages at your leisure. It's interesting stuff. I mean, if you read from point to point, at one point, the Israelites thought that they had annihilated every single male of the Edomites, but one of them escaped and fled to Egypt. And that was the rebirth of the Edomites, and then they were able to rebel further against later kings. That's during the period of the kings, which we will not have time to look at, but it's exciting. It's one of these great stories. Okay, Numbers chapter 20, and we'll begin reading in verse 14. Okay. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that we have met, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt a long time. And the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and our fathers. And when we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent out an angel and brought us out of Egypt. And here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or vineyard or drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory. But Edom said to him, you shall not pass through, lest I come out with the sword against you. And the people of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway. And if we drink of your water, I and my livestock, then I will pay for it. Let me only pass through on foot, nothing more. But he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against them with a large army and a strong force. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. Now that's just the start. There are wars and more wars with the Edomites, and that's the first example of conflict after Jacob and Esau lived on earth between these two nations. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And I'm just skipping over it for the sake of time, because we want to focus more on what Obadiah says exactly. Okay, here's just an artist's rendition of Jacob trying to deceive his father. And I want you to see if you can see. It's kind of hard to see here, but he's got Esau right over here. Esau evidently is discovering what's going on as the scene unfolds. We don't know about that for sure, but that's an interesting thing. Okay. Practical lessons in the book of Esau, in the book of Obadiah. I want you to know that the book of Obadiah has a lot of good lessons for us. And one of those has to do with brotherliness, that it's very important for us to be good brethren toward one another. And this is a family feud, and we don't want family feuds. We don't want them in our own families, certainly. I think every one of us has been touched with some kind of conflict in our own families, and I hope that none of us is ever responsible for a family conflict. Isn't that sad? What ruins your life more than strife within a family? I suppose there's nothing that hits us worse than when brother or sister or father and mother or father and son or brother and brother have conflicts, and it's a very tragic thing. Let us never be responsible for that. A couple of verses on it. Proverbs 17 and verse 17 says, a friend loveth at all times, but a brother is born for adversity. And that's how it ought to be. It ought to be that when you feel like you can't turn to anybody else because you're in trouble, you can turn to your brother. But it wasn't that case. Here the Israelites were in great need of their brother's help. They were in this wandering in the wilderness trying to find safe passage, and the brother wouldn't let them through. It's a very tragic thing. How about Proverbs 17 and verse 5? It says, whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at his calamity will not go unpunished. So what if your brother is in need? Like the Good Samaritan found somebody in need, and he was a neighbor to him. And Did he mock him? Did he say, oh, this person, well, surely it was his own fault. You know, I don't want to have anything to do with him. No, that wasn't his attitude. He took a charitable attitude. And that really should be our default position as well, that we want to help people. And sometimes people do put themselves in hard positions. And for us to do something for them in some cases might be to enable them to keep doing it or to endorse their sin or something like that. But in general, we want to help people who are in need. That ought to be our attitude. Okay, comments or questions on that? Do we have a brotherly attitude in the church? I certainly hope we do. How do you want your brother in your family to treat you? And then think about how God uses the idea of brothers and sisters to apply to the church. We should be a true family in the Lord, to have this bond of love for one another as a family. That's very important. Okay, yes. And Herod was a descendant of them. That's right. Herod was a descendant. He was an Idumean, is the exact word for it. And Idumea was by that time the name. It's another name for Edom. It's just a morphed version of Edom. You can even see it. You'll see that word. Herod is called an I-D-U-M-E-A-N, Idumean. And that's an Edomite. And you're absolutely right. So when it comes to time for Herod to try to kill all the babies in order to get Jesus killed, here we have again, Jesus a descendant of Jacob, Herod a descendant of Esau. And the conflict keeps on going. That's right. So they were getting engulfed at that stage into the larger nation of Israel. And they are not identifiable anymore. But at that time, there were still descendants of Esau that you would call an Idumean. But that's really as much a reference to the land. Idumea is a land area, too. The same area that we were pointing to before as calling it Edom, that would later be called Idumea. That's right. Okay, anything else on that? Brotherliness is very important. Okay, in the second place, God knows what we do. Don't you suppose that there were Edomites who over the centuries had, in their country, they had mistreated Jacob? Some of them were involved in it and had thought nothing about the God of heaven knowing what they were doing. We know they were idolatrous. There's a story about King Amaziah going and killing a bunch of Edomites. The king of Judah went and killed a bunch of Edomites. And then, it's in your readings if you look there. And then he started worshiping the god of the Edomites. He got back from killing them, and then he set up gods for the Edomites and started worshiping them. And God sent a prophet to him, and I'm paraphrasing, but just said, why are you worshiping a god that didn't even deliver the people you just went and conquered? He didn't have a good answer for that. But here are people who are idolatrous and had forgotten about the God of heaven. And then all of a sudden, here comes this oracle from Obadiah that says, your time has come. Don't you suppose there are Edomites who said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? You're saying that there's a God who's going to hold us accountable for all this? A true God in heaven? Not these gods that we've made up for ourselves, but another God? Now, don't you think that on the day of judgment, there'll be people who are just like that, who say, what do you mean I'm going to be called into account? Called into account by who? I don't believe in any God. I think it'll be just that way. And yet God knows what we do. Questions or comments about that? What verse would you use to demonstrate that, other than Obadiah? Go somewhere else in the Bible and say, here's a verse that teaches that God is aware of all the things that people do. Okay, well, I think you're thinking of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and I believe it's verse 13, that God will call into judgment every work of man, including every secret thing. So God knows all the secret things. He will call into judgment every deed, whether good or bad, with every secret thing. How about Psalm 139 and verse 7? Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? And then he goes on to enumerate all the places he could try to go to run from God, and yet he says God would know wherever he was. God would be aware of it. Okay. Next thing. The Lord is in control of the kingdoms of men. So when God wants to bring judgment upon people, he's perfectly capable of doing it. No nation or ruler has ever been inviolable. when it comes to God's judgment. Nobody can say, I'm untouchable by God. The greatest kingdoms of the world have come under God's judgment. The best example of that, my favorite one, I guess, because it has so much to do with Christianity, is the Roman Empire. And if you want to read God's judgment on the most powerful empire, the first world empire, really in the true sense of conquering the only land that anybody really ever cared about at that point, was the Roman Empire. And the book of Revelation details what God is going to do to them because of their unrighteousness. No kingdom, however powerful, is still a kingdom of men. And God is still in control of all that and can call them into judgment. Okay, Babylon was the same way. You know, Babylon is the kingdom that's going to conquer the Jews. But then God's going to call Babylon into account. And God's going to use the Greeks, well, the Persians, and then the Greeks to really just obliterate that empire. And so God can do whatever he wants to. God's in control. And that's comforting for us today, too, isn't it? That God's justice will be meted out. Now, it may be that some innocent people have to suffer in the course of God meting out his earthly judgment. Sometimes innocent people do suffer when God's judgment upon nations happens. And that's unfortunate. But if you're right with God, even if you suffer during the time when God's judgment, temporal earthly judgment, is meted out, then you get to go to heaven. So it's not a problem in the long run. Any questions or comments about that? Okay, coming from a good family is not enough. Now, Esau came from a good family, didn't he? He was just as much a son of Isaac as Jacob was. And yet, look at the disastrous results. Now, there may be some people who say, oh, my parents are Christians. I come from a real good family. You know, my dad was an elder, or my dad was a preacher. Look at my grandfather was so-and-so, and he was a faithful Christian. And my mom was such a good Christian. How could I possibly be lost? Well, you're not going to be saved or lost based on what your mama did, but it's based on your relationship to God. I was talking to a young man the other day. He's older than me, but he's not an old man. And he was saying that his great-grandfather and his uncle, I believe, and I think even his dad, were all preachers. And he's apostate. He's left the church. And he said, Caleb, you would be shocked at how little I know about the Bible. And here he's been out of the church since maybe he was, I don't know how old, but he's been out for a long time. And he's lost. And I think he knows he's lost. When I was visiting to him, I was visiting with another person, and we talked to him pretty strongly about the state of his soul. And his wife is apostate also. And he was telling me about his faithful ancestors. And then he was saying, I don't know anything about the Bible. And what a tragic thing. Can he go to heaven on his father's ticket? Can he go to heaven on his grandfather's ticket? None of us can do that. And so here's Edom. The Edomites are descendants from a great family, and yet they're lost. Okay, that could happen to any of us if we're not faithful to the Lord, right? Questions or comments about that? Okay, pride comes before a fall. We read in the book, Edom is specifically condemned because of pride. You know, you might say that pride is the great sin in the Bible, because you can link every other sin to pride as the root of it. I think you know that's why Jesus said the first of the Beatitudes was blessed are the what? No, not meek, but blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. People who are in the kingdom of God are the people who recognize they need the kingdom of God. They recognize that they're in a position to cry out to the Lord for help. And if you think of yourself as being just all right the way you are, with no help from God, well, then there's no way you can be saved. What if you've got a member of the church who says, I'm too good to really serve? Or here's this job that the church might need me to do, but I'm too good to do that. Or I'm too exalted for this. Or what an attitude. Can somebody go to heaven like that? Can somebody go to heaven saying, Lord, I know that you would like me to do this, but I'm too good to do that. Or I can be saved based on my own merit. I can be saved based on my earning my salvation. that will lead us to be lost. A couple of verses on that. For example, James 4:6 says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to who? The humble. Now, any sin, I said a minute ago, any sin could be linked to pride. I really think that anytime anybody sins, there is at the very least this underlying attitude. Now, well, let me back up. Sometimes people sin out of ignorance or stupidity, and I believe that there are sins that members of the church commit that are not prideful sins, but more or less accidental sins. They are not living a life where they are intentionally sinning. They're fighting against sin, but sometimes they accidentally, out of stupidity or weakness, do make mistakes. But sin in general is linked to pride, because somebody says, I can do things my way. That God says for me to do things one way, I'm going to do them another way. Or I don't need God to tell me what to do. Or God can't tell me what to do. That is the heart that produces sin. Now, next. God uses tools to accomplish his will. God used Israel to punish Edom. God used Babylon to punish Israel. God used Babylon to punish Judah. God used Assyria to punish Israel. God used these nations to punish one another. When their time had come, God allowed them to be overrun. God used the various nations, the Germanic tribes, the barbarians, to destroy the Roman Empire because they had gotten so sinful. Now, what is the message? God can use us to accomplish his will. God can take people who... Now, listen, I mean, many of these nations that God used were wicked, wicked people. Really awful. I mean, the Babylonians were awful, but God used them to do his will. They were his agent. The Assyrians were some of the wickedest people you could shake a stick at. And yet God used them to carry out his will. Now, what about you and I? You may say, well, I'm very weak. I'm somebody who is... Look at me. I can't do this, and I can't do this, and I can't do this. All these things. And I have such a sinful background. I've done some bad things in my life. All of these strikes I have against me. And yet, what can God do? God can take somebody who's maybe an unlikely hero and use him for great good. God can use tools in the way he wants. So if we will put ourselves in the hand of the Master and allow him to do with us whatever he will, then God can accomplish many great things. What if someone says, oh, I'm just a child. I can't do big things for God. Has a child ever done anything really important for God? Who can think of an example in the Bible? Okay, David. David was just a lad, wasn't he, when he went and tried to help his brothers and wound up killing Goliath? That's very good. What else? Did you say David too? Okay, what about Samuel? Samuel, from a very young age, was learning how to be a servant of God and serves as a great example. What about Jesus? When Jesus was 12 years old, he was already engaging in discussions about the Word of God and so forth. We could go on. Daniel would be a good example. Yes. Okay, Joseph. Joseph was very young when he was sold into... He was underage when he was sold into Egyptian slavery. And so here is an example. Here are many examples where we say unlikely candidates because they're young. They might be unlikely candidates because they're old. They might be, and yet there are great examples of old people serving God in magnificent ways. They unlikely candidates for any number of reasons. Well, the enemies that God used to punish these nations were unlikely candidates. You wouldn't think of them as being God's agents, and yet God can use them to do good things. So never tell yourself, for example, I can't convert anybody because I'm not a preacher. Well, I don't know how much to say about this, but we're thinking about a new initiative about evangelism that might be very good for each individual member to be able to teach people over the internet the gospel. You'll be hearing more about that soon, but there are all kinds of ways that people can... You can just teach your neighbors and friends as it is. You don't need a special tool to do it, but we're thinking about a new tool on that. But never shortchange yourself as a servant of God. Okay, next point. And the last one, and that is that God will accomplish his purposes. Obadiah, in a verse or two, uses a particular tense that's called the past perfect. That is, it's something that is in the past and has already been accomplished. And yet it hasn't really happened yet in history. According at the time Obadiah was written, it had not occurred. And yet he uses the past tense. Let me see if I can find the verse. I'm sorry about that. Let's see. You will find it shortly. But he uses the past tense for something that has already, that has not happened yet. And that shows, when you find it, it shows that God can certainly accomplish whatever he wants. You and I cannot. We cannot certainly accomplish what we want to accomplish. We can possibly accomplish. When you and I have goals and we try to work them out, it may happen or it may not happen. We do our best. We see if we can accomplish it. But when God has a purpose, it certainly comes to pass. There's no question about it. So God can talk about something that hasn't even happened yet as if it has already happened. And that's very important. God's purposes are absolutely certain. He will do whatever he wants to do. And we need to remember that that's the kind of God we serve. We don't serve a God whose purposes are perhaps uncertain because he's all-powerful. It's very important to remember how God views all of human history, that he sees it all at one time. That's part of God's eternity. I'm going to stop as the kids come in a minute. But when we say that God is eternal, that implies that he is not experiencing one moment after another where God could be surprised by what happens. We can. When we go along from one moment to the next, we don't know what's going to happen. We have predictions based on what customarily happens, but we don't know for sure from one moment to the next. But God, on the other hand, he sees, this is all of human history, let's say, he sees it all at once. He sees from the beginning to the end of it. He sees all time from eternity. And if you're in eternity, then there is no time. That means it's an area where it's not bound by succession, moment to moment. When you get to heaven, you'll live in one moment forever. There will be one instant that lasts forever because there's no time. And I'm looking forward to that because there will be no aging and there will be no disappointments and there will be none of many of the bad things that we encounter on earth. The point we need to remember here is that when God says something is going to happen, it's as good as done. Because he doesn't, it's not as though he's got to wait and see if it can happen. When he says this is going to happen, it's as if it already has, because he's in eternity. Okay, questions or comments about that? Did anybody find that verse that is in the past tense about something that's already happened yet? I really thought I saw that, and then I lost it for a minute.